This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, say potato and language says potato. Coming up in today's show, Britain, the USA, united by a common language, driven apart by minor linguistic differences. We can't even agree on whether pants are the garments you wear under or over your pants. How did it come to this, listeners? That is the question we're addressing today. On with the show.
We mostly speak the same language, and you know, that's obvious in the fact that, we are having this conversation now, that we don't need subtitles.
Lynn Murphy is a professor of English language and linguistics at Sussex University in southern England. She writes the blog Separated by a Common Language, and she has a new book out, The Prodigal Tongue, all about how Brits and Americans use English differently.
I'm from upstate New York and was educated in the US. But I've lived in the UK, particularly in Brighton, England, for 18 years now. And so as I go through my daily life, I notice a lot of differences between British and American English.
You've heard Lynn Murphy on The Allusionist before, in the episode about the word please.
The theme of the post by British people was, if you don't say please, you sound bossy. And the theme of the American commenters was, if you say please, then you sound bossy.
What? Help!
I'm so confused. And ever since, I've been second-guessing myself whenever trying to be polite in the USA. Now, one thing that Britain and the US do seem to have in common is the enthusiasm for noticing we use English differently. Every week, my inbox is full of Americans asking, why did you British person say this thing, which isn't how we say it here? And Brits saying, please confirm my prejudice about this which I perceive to be an Americanism. And yes, we've all noted by now that Americans don't spell colour or neighbour with a U, because who needs it? And Brits snigger uncontrollably at fanny pack. We know that British and American Englishes are different, but the question is, why?
People will say to me, well, why do British people say this and American people say that? And they like, well, because they learned English in different places. You know, there's no real philosophical explanation for it. It's just that you learned English around people who were saying one thing or the other, and it happened.
I've said before that one significant reason for differences is that there is an ocean between us. Geographical separation enables separate evolution. But there's also an ocean between Britain and Australia, and Britain and Canada, and Britain and South Africa, and Britain and every other country that has its own strain of English. So why is it that the difference between American and British Englishes in particular seems so much bigger than the others?
In terms of the language, in terms of how different they are linguistically, they are more different than the other ones. And there are a few reasons for that. One is that American English got started earlier than the other ones. So the first English people settled in what's now the US in the early 1600s, whereas it was the 1800s for Australia and South Africa. So, you know, you've got a 200 or 150 year really head start for the language.
In the 19th century, American and British Englishes began diverging more when the physical distance between them grew greater, as in the US, people pushed west.
Up until the Revolution, you know, most people who were in America lived on the, or not most people, most white people, most Europeans in America, lived on the East Coast. And there were new people coming in from Britain all the time. And so there was a lot of contact between Britain and America. And then after the Revolution, obviously, there was less immigration. Australia was looking more appealing. Canada was looking more appealing. So we had less contact with Britain. And at the same time, people started moving westward. And so as people moved westward, they had less and less contact with the, you know, book publishers of the East and the people coming over from England and all that sort of stuff. So they were moving west. And they were very mixed groups of people moving west, so they had what we call dialect leveling. They started talking more the same as each other, and that sort of started sounding American. So they're moving west, there's more distance between Britain and America, and the other thing that's happening then is we start getting large numbers of immigrants from other parts of Europe, from Germany, from later Scandinavia, Ireland, Italy. And so with those people coming into the mix and English developing in its own way, there was, yeah, a lot less attention to what Britain was doing.
Coupled with a deliberate departure from what Britain was doing.
You've also got the political distinction. So Americans are the only ones of those who fought a war against Britain to maintain their independence, or to gain their independence, rather. So that meant that Americans had more interest in distinguishing themselves from the British than, say, the Australians or the Canadians did. So, you know, from the beginning of the United States, there was a push. It was always a controversial push. It did not happen quickly or naturally, but there was a push to make ourselves a bit different from Britain, and you see that in the spelling system in particular.
So would you say that it's not necessarily the distinction that's important, it's just the fact that there is a distinction, like we want to maintain differences between our versions of English?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, language is how we express our identity in a really, really big way. You know, you can express it by how you dress or what, you know, hobbies you have or things like that. But speaking is how you show you're from a place. And so we maintain the difference because we come from different places and we want to talk like the people around us, the people who we think are cool, who are around us.
So there is a tendency to think our way is the correct way and the other ways are deviating from the correct way.
A very common idea is that American English is somehow the child of British English, but it's not. They're both children of a common ancestor.
When you think of it like that, how many of your distant cousins do you have as much in common with as British and American English do have with each other? Each side of the Atlantic holds presumptions about the other's version of English. For example, in Britain, it's common to consider what one perceives as Americanisms to be new and wrong, while Americans seem to think that British English is classier and more correct. So we got lucky there.
Any English person who's been to America will have heard people say, "Oh, I love your accent."
That's my core market.
Oh, that's so sexy.
Americans who just want to listen to accents. If they ever get wise to the fact that we're not smarter and better because of the accent, then my career is scuttled.
You know, there is this idea that if you go to America with an English accent, you will have 15 to 20 IQ points granted to you without question, that you can talk your way out of anything, that you'll be treated extra special. But there is a sense that the British accent is somehow special. You can buy T-shirts that say everything sounds sexy in a British accent, or everything sounds better in a British accent, which, of course, British people get upset about because they say, well, there is no such thing as a British accent.
Britain, unable to accept a compliment gracefully.
But yeah, so there is that sense in America that the language does come from England, that maybe the English know better about it, that maybe the way we talk is ugly. And that is something that has influenced America from the beginning, and our attitude toward English. So as I say, when American English started to change, people were very self-conscious about that. They couldn't really keep track of it because there was too much distance between Britain and America and no, you know, Skype calls or anything like that. So they were worried. They were a bit worried that their English was changing. And throughout the 19th century, the fight was still going on about whether to spell color with a U. And a lot of Americans felt like it's not our language to play with. We should be respecting the language of Shakespeare. But what we have seen is that attitude has been lessening and lessening. For one reason, there are a lot fewer Americans with British heritage than there were, you know, 150 years ago. So fewer Americans now have a connection to the old country. For many Americans, it's not the old country. So there's not the same Britocentrism that there was in the early days of America. But also, I think as the world has got smaller and we have been able to talk to each other more, you get to know people as people and not just as some sort of ideal. It's not about actually loving England. It's about loving an idea of England that you get on Sherlock and Downton Abbey and things like that. But as the world gets smaller and as we see more of each other and talk to more different people, I think those kinds of attitudes lessen a bit.
It's interesting, the cultural exports that you mention, because those do seem to skew to a particular echelon of Britain.
They absolutely do.
Downton Abbey is squarely upper class. That's not most people's reality.
Yeah, Downton Abbey is very upper class. Sherlock's very posh. James Bond, very dapper and debonair. But then you've got all these other imports to America from Britain, like Shameless, where instead of importing the British version, they've reset it, I think in Chicago, right? So there are a lot of things on British television about people who are not in the posh classes, but those aren't the things that are exported in whole. Americans like to hear the accents on Downton Abbey, but when it's Shameless or when it's Till Death Do Us Part, which was turned into All in the Family in America, then the accents become a bit more different, the social situation becomes harder to understand, and people aren't sort of willing to put in the work. In part, probably because it doesn't fit their idea of what it's like to be English.
But interestingly, there are several linguistic traits that don't fit British ideas of what it is like to be British, and are thus chalked up as Americanisms. For example, the suffix IZE, that was the British spelling until the 19th century, when ISE started becoming more popular. Gotten isn't an Americanism, it was the past tense of get in Middle English, appearing at least 100 years before Europeans reached what is now the United States. Also from around the 14th century in Britain is the use of mad to mean angry. But when the spellings alter or the usage of a word tails off in Britain but not the US, then when it creeps back into Britain, people will often assume it's a newfangled Americanism. This is called novelty bias.
So novelty bias is that you notice things when they're different. We've all got a bias toward noticing the things that we don't usually hear, not noticing the things we usually hear, and then making stereotypes based on the things that are new.
Brits get furious about the idea of these foreign invaders coming here like the grey squirrel to wipe out the home squirrel. But do you get that the other way round? Does the USA have similar resentment of Britishisms coming over to infect the vocabulary?
There's a little bit of consciousness about what comes over from Britain in America, but mostly what people notice as British are the words that are sort of cute, like gobsmacked, or, you know, a lot of naughty words that come over from Britain, like bollocks and wanker, which Americans think are funny because they heard them on Austin Powers or something like that.
And to be fair, they are funny words, but not all funny words are British. For example, bumbershoot.
Americans believe that bumbershoot is a British word for umbrella, and that's why it's in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and that's why it's in the mouth of Daphne and Frasier, you know. And we stereotype British people as saying bumbershoot, but of course British people have no idea what bumbershoot means because it's an American word.
So the assumption is, if a word sounds silly, it must be from Britain. And even if the application of this maxim is not always correct, there is evidence for it in each country's respective terms for evacuating one's bodily waste, as we don't say in Britain.
Well, in terms of the bodily functions, you've got, you know, wee and poo, which I think is very babyish words, but grown-ups, you know, say, I'm going for a wee, or don't step in that poo. And in America, you do have those kinds of things, or you have the sort of avoidance euphemisms like, I'm going to the bathroom, or I have pain when I go to the bathroom, which is very clearly not about the journey to the room, but is about some physical act of evacuation. So the different, slightly different kinds of avoidance. I mentioned the pee and poo thing because I was sitting in my doctor's office and there were signs there. It said pee instead of wee, which I found interesting. But it said, if there's blood in your pee, tell your doctor immediately. And I immediately Googled American public health signs to see what they said. And they'd say urine. And instead of saying poo, they said stool. You know, so Americans were avoiding being crude by using these terms that you'd sort of only use in the doctor's office. And Brits were avoiding being crude by using sort of cutesy baby words.
But as ridiculous as British English is characterized, Lynn reckons that Americans have an inferiority complex about their version of English.
Americans are very conscious. Well, not all Americans, obviously, but probably the type who listen to your podcast tend to be very conscious about linguistic rules. And so you do get tendencies to hypercorrection, you know, like saying between you and I instead of between you and me.
That example is certainly not exclusive to Americans. But hypercorrection is the assumption that there's a more prestigious version of language than the one you're familiar with. Then, in trying to emulate it, you over-apply or misuse the rules.
But you also get a lot of rules in America that aren't really hard and fast rules in Britain. So things like the rule in America that if you have a singular subject, you have to have a singular verb. So we always would say something like, the band is breaking up or something like that, rather than the band are breaking up or the band are on tour, which you'd hear a lot more of in Britain. So Americans like to have one rule that does the job and not a lot of room for debate about which would be the right form. Another example of that is the which that distinction. So the difference between I have a hamster that goes under the sofa versus I have a hamster which goes under the sofa. And if you make the distinction, then the first one means I have a hamster, I might have two hamsters, one that goes under the sofa and one that doesn't. And the other one, I'm only saying that I have one hamster and I'm telling you something about it. So that's the difference between restrictive and non-restrictive relative clauses.
Hi, British person here. What? Could you run that past me again? I never learned. We never learned that stuff in England.
Yeah, but I had that, you know, I was let known that if I wanted to sound like a sophisticated user of English, I had to make a distinction between that and which. And that's a completely sort of fake rule. So that was a rule that an English style guide writer devised because he thought it would make English more elegant. And then Americans just took to town. And so Americans make the that which distinction, especially in printed writing, much, much more than British people do. And British people are sort of either unaware of the distinction or that the distinction can be made or just don't care because it's not how people talk. And you don't have to learn about English because you'll already know English. Americans like to have these books that tell them you say it this way and you don't say it that way. You know, you say the team is, you never say the team are. Whereas British style books will say, well, the team is, the team are. It's hard to tell. There's no real rule. You just have to have an ear for it. And otherwise, well, it's a bit of a mystery and maybe you'll get it someday. Whereas the Americans have this deep belief that you can always improve if you work hard. You know, that's not necessarily the reason why you want to learn about grammar. You want to learn about grammar, for me, so that you can talk intelligently about paragraphs and things like that when you, you know, come to have written something and need to have a conversation about how it could be better. That does help. But also you want to learn about grammar because, my God, this is the most central part of being human, using language. And why wouldn't we want to understand it better?
Despite their differences, British and American versions of English have both been extremely successful languages since they sprouted from their shared root. But Lynn, how are things looking for them in the future?
In the 19th century, English made its mark very much through the British Empire, and through the United States becoming an English-speaking nation and becoming a very populous one. So I call the 19th century the British century, the British-English century. American English really came into its own in the 20th century, became powerful then because of television, film, and that sort of thing, and the American economy more generally. And then as we go into the 21st century, the number of English speakers speaking it not as their first language from other countries than these two is greater than the number speaking it as a native language. And so those are the English speakers who will be taking English into new directions now and who are increasingly speaking to each other without Americans or Brits as middlemen, who are making an English that can be considered a sort of world English. And when people talk about that, they often worry that that means that the traditions of British English or American English are going to be lost. They won't. I mean, we're still speaking the way we speak, but there might be a form of English that is more accessible to more people that you might hear more of on the international news or things like that.
And this is nothing to panic about.
English deserves our love, but it doesn't deserve our worry, because it does take care of itself, and we should just admire it and see where it goes and appreciate that it doesn't have to be just one thing.
Lynn Murphy's new book is The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between British and American English.
Unless you live in America, in which case the subtitle is The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English.
Of course. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is vigesimal, adjective, relating to or based on the number 20. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with Martin Austwick, who also makes the music you hear on the show. Find Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter. Over on the Allusionist website, there are transcripts, there is additional material about every episode topic, and a photo of the full dictionary entry of the randomly selected word of the day if you want to check the spelling to use it in the emails. There are links to lots of different ways to hear the show. By the way, if you listen via the Apple Podcasts app, make sure to keep your subscription alive, because if you don't listen to the most recent four episodes, it stops updating your feed with new episodes. And I keep hearing from listeners asking if I'm retired. I'm not ready to retire. You can always find me keeping on at theallusionist.org.